Have you ever stopped to wonder why it's so easy to create our ideal RPG characters, but so difficult to create our ideal selves? If you want to become just as confident and empowered in real life as your D&D character is at the table, join me for my brand new Identi-D&D life coaching workshop. I use the character building framework from D&D for a casual but really effective way to identify what's holding you back from being the best version of yourself. Listen in at the end of the episode to learn more.
Welcome to The Compendium, a resource designed to help you spend less time learning D&D and more time actually playing.
Welcome back to The Compendium as we dive into yet another race. Yes, jazz hands there for all of you that can't see Jason.
You're going to out me like that, huh? Okay, fine.
I got to keep it interesting for all of our COVID.
I thought the video was just for us, Casey.
Oh, think nothing. All right, so this week we wanted to dive into halflings. So we're kind of continuing this trend of exploring races, starting with the most well-known ones. And halflings, I think, honestly, might be one of the more well-known ones if you put them in the context of hobbits, because mm-hmm. that is what Tolkien calls them in his series with Lord of the Rings. And I think that's how a lot of people are aware of halflings in that regard. So this episode, we are going to break down all about halflings, kind of their living environment, where they come from, what calls them to adventure, some of the different bonuses that you're going to get if you play a halfling, and then some of the sub-races that you can dive into as well to spice things up and kind of individualize your halfling a little bit more. Yep. So let's just start with, you know, let's talk a little bit about who they are, where they live, what they do, and get a feel for the community that are halflings.
Yeah, exactly. So halflings are not hobbits only because hobbit is a trademark term.
Right.
Now,
closest
I'm sure,
association.
Yeah, I am sure there is some interview or article somewhere where they're like, actually, but as you read their entry in the player's handbook and see them depicted in different things, they're just hobbits. And so if you have read The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings or seen the movies, you already have a pretty good understanding of what these creatures are. And unlike some of the other things we've looked at, like dwarves and elves, where we're like, well, you know, a lot of cultures have different thoughts on what elves are. And some of them are small and make cookies, and others make toys, and others are amazing archers. Halflings are just halflings. And I can't really think of a good example of halflings in other media other than D&D and kind of Lord of the Rings. They are very related to kind of the myriad of like fae creatures, like, you know, brownies and sprites and things from like English lore, or like leprechauns or something. They might be actually really close to leprechauns in some ways, but
except they don't really care about gold.
They don't, but they are
similar
very,
in other aspects.
Yeah, I mean, I think in their stature, I think in their luckiness and their like love of not trickery, but maybe like little pranks and being hard to find.
Shenanigans.
That's the right word. Yes. The love of shenanigans and things and being kind of far away from the rest of life. They are very similar to leprechauns in that way, but they're not, because they're not fae creatures. They're straight up mortal, unlike elves and some other things.
They don't have any innately magical properties,
right? Not really, for the most part, no. Like your standard halfling doesn't have any innate magic other than the fact that I think is that they're very lucky. Like they're just seen as being very lucky, and we'll get to that in a
That's
second.
That's kind of like thinking like a rabbit's foot, though. Like, you know, some people think is lucky, that, you know, it's up for debate, is it not, but they don't, it's not like a tiefling or some of these other races that just by existence they have this weird little spark of magic that exists inside of them. And so when you're referring to them as like sort of similar to fae creatures, we're not implying that there is some sort of innate magic that just lives inside of them, but people might regard them like almost with a superstition, maybe.
Yeah, more superstition than like out and out magic in D&D worlds. And so as far as like their culture and like their their personalities, they're very much like the English, right? Very practical. They like to stay home, family and friends, very warm, cozy living spaces. And they can kind of just, you know, integrate anywhere, but oftentimes they're kind of tucked away in a corner and kind of do their own thing. That's kind of their whole thing, is they're everyone's like best friend, basically. They don't like to make a lot of ruckus. They just want to live in peace and, you know, enjoy a good meal and a warm fire and a conversation after dinner. You know, that's their whole thing.
Yeah, it's kind of that concept of community or fellowship. Mm. Like, that is their fundamental, like, core thing that they're going for in life, is contentment within the social relations of kind of their network, I guess, especially yeah. family network, from my understanding.
Yeah, very much. And I could easily see like in a D&D party that the halfling character is the one who's always checking on people to make sure they're okay, and maybe even trying to calm some arguments between other players' characters. And they just want this big family that they've found to kind of keep working well and everyone to get along. And so they're not going to be the instigators for sure. I think they might even be reluctant to take sides in certain things, just mm-hmm. based on the lore, but they want to be mediators in a family sense, right? Like, there's an argument in your house, you know, mom is the one who steps in and says, "Hey, everyone just take 5 minutes, go to your rooms. We'll talk about this in a minute, probably over like, you know, a cup of tea and some cookies English. Or biscuits." Yeah, English, exactly.
English. Oh my gosh, I love it.
In my experience, there's nothing a cup of tea can fix. Yeah. So that's very much them. And also with halflings too, oftentimes, like I described, they're going to be off in their own little like shires or little towns, kind of in the corners of empires, because they're not empire builders. They don't accumulate wealth just for wealth's sake, like a dwarf does. They love beauty and novelty, but not like an elf that's going to make this grand thing over hundreds of years. And while they are mundane, they don't, you know, create industry and great castles and things like humans do. They're very content people with curiosity built into them and novelty built into them. And it doesn't take a lot for them to be interested in something. Even seeing like, you know, a different way of dressing is like, "Oh, that's really cool. How did you make that? What's that fabric? How did you do this turn?" Like, they're going to be interested. And so while they do have a reputation of being like homebodies and just like wanting like family home and comfort, home and hearth, it's not a stretch to see why they might be adventuring. Because they like this idea of just finding new and interesting things and having a bit of a wanderlust, or just, you know, getting the most out of life, I think is a good idea there as well.
Yeah, it reminds me, as you were describing, that kind of like a childlike curiosity or childlike sense of wonder, in that, you know, children know where their home is. They know their home is safe. It's where, mm-hmm. you know, they're okay and the world is all good. But then they're always interested in everything and they want to try everything. And they're curious about, well, what is this new thing? A little bit like Jack Skellington when he's in Christmas Land.
What's this?
Like, yeah. Oh, this is all so exciting. And that's kind of what that reminded me of a little bit.
Yeah. And there's an argument that's been made on the internet multiple places that there is a old school race in D&D called the Kinder, which are very much even more what we're talking about here, where they're like very small, they're slight, and they have like a childlike wonder all the time to the extreme. It very is Jack Skellington. What's this? What's this? But the hobbits are a bit more subdued than that, because it's not so much like, "I just got to go out and experience the world, Ma." It's more like, "Oh, well, I heard this really funny joke when I was traveling in this other town," or, "Oh, this is how they're doing it in Luskin, where they wear their hats like this." And like, they're just interested in people, because people allow you to form relationships. And I think relationship really is the driving force for a lot of halflings. So whether that is to defend, they might go adventuring to defend their homes. They might go adventuring to help out an ally or a friend, or just to, you know, see the wider world and what their place in it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that makes sense too, with how the player's handbook breaks down their sense of, I don't want to say law, but kind of like that social economic organization. Like, there really is no nobility. There's no royalty. Those concepts, those constructs don't exist because they look towards the elders within, you know, their communities for advice or for, you know, leadership. And so it's kind of coming back to what you were saying about how, you know, it's all about community. It's all about relationships, even in the hierarchy of how they live their lives and kind of see right and wrong or good and evil, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, it's a very simple social structure for sure. And it really does tie into this idea of their one large community, and they know all the different families and things, but an elder from a different family may have, you know, a good wisdom for you or make a good decision for the whole of the group, and you're okay with that. Whereas like dwarves, they have their houses, right? Their clans. And so a suggestion by one rival clan may not be okay with some other clans. And so there's still deliberation until the nobles or king or whatever makes the final call. And there's more bickering and political intrigue. With the halflings, you don't really see that often. They're more, like you said, the fundamental driving force for them seems to be relationship.
Yeah, I think that's important too, because it actually struck me, you know, I thought of them being homebodies, and they're not, they're community bodies, because it even says in here, like, they might not even have a physical home. They might be kind of nomads where they live on a wagon or something like that, traveling from place to place. And that sounded like, when I read that, it clashed with my concept or my stereotype idea of what the halflings are. But with more understanding, it makes sense, because it's all about the people that you're with, and those people can travel with you in your covered wagon or in your boat or whatever it might be.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There might be like just roving caravans of like Bedouin, halflings. And in fact, in the world of Eberron on Corvair, they live in a giant desert. They ride dinosaurs and they're desert nomads, which is awesome. But it, even though that's radically different than like the Shire, it's still consistent because of that that kind of undertow of relationship, and home is where you make it and family is whom you make it. So I really like that. And they're just so wholesome. I just really like halflings.
Yeah, they're pretty great. The more I read about them, the more I'm like, oh, I either want a halfling friend in real life. I think I actually have a halfling friend in real life, to be perfectly honest. They're fairly small in stature and just like the kindest soul you'll ever meet.
And so the fact that we're getting to that point by just talking about the halflings, that's the power of the halflings. We're like, they're awesome. I like them. Yeah. So that's, I think we're on it very, very well. There's two other kind of notable features about this, just in lore, I think, when it comes to halflings. And one is that they have endured over the centuries, not by force of might, not by ingenuity, not by, hiding under the mountains deep, but by basically just staying out of the way, where they will just, they live in among other communities. Like, so in a human kingdom, there might be a giant population of halflings because humans are okay. And their empires, while we have no interest in them, they keep us safe, or they're going to live off the beaten path and kind of treat the best security is obscurity, is kind of their idea. And that links into this other idea that they are lucky. And there's all these stories and little hooks and things over the years of D&D of where they'll survive like a, you know, an invading horde of orcs and ogres and giants and things, and they just miss them, right? They just like, they march down the main road and they don't take the little fork off to the side that leads around the other side of a lake and past the woods, and that's where the halflings live, because they just didn't go that way. And so they're very lucky, and they always end up being kind of just in the right place at the right time. And that's because, and this is like super deep lore, this isn't even in the player's handbook, which is crazy, is that they have an association with a variety of usually female luck-based deities. In the old days, it was Avandra, and she was one of the main core deities in 4th edition, and then she's not in 5th edition. Her closest kind of corresponding deity is Timora, who is a luck goddess. But in the old days, Avandra...
Back in my day!
After everyone else had created their races, Avandra and others either it's Hazy either adopted or created the halflings and blessed them not with might, not with skill, not with magic, but with luck. And so while there's never going to be like big temples or shrines to any of these deities, I think it says someplace I read earlier today that they'll often kind of like, if they just like, you know, dodge out of the way of a falling piece of rubble from a, you know, the roof of a house or something, and they, it misses them, they'll say a quick prayer to Evandra or Timora. And so she's kind of like watching over them in this really indirect kind of vague way. That's kind of her blessing to them. And so they kind of like have a head nod to that deity, whoever she may be in whatever version you're playing. But they're not overly religious because they are pretty self-reliant, and they will not reach out to a god. They'll reach out to each other because, again, it's about relationships and the allies that you form.
Right. I mean, it's that concept where a lot of people, when they experience like a near death like moment, where they'll make the symbol of the cross, whether or not they're religious or not. It's, I think it's kind of that idea of like, if there is something out there, I want to make sure that I say thank you because that was close.
They'll say, oh, thank God. And they're like, do you go to church? And they're like, no. And you're like, okay, never mind. Doesn't worry about it. Yeah. Like, yeah. Every atheist believes in God in the foxhole, right? That's the old saying. So very much this way as well.
Well, so. I like that. I actually really love that imagery because it makes, I think it makes for a wonderful lead in as to why hobbits, oh my gosh, I'm doing it too.
Yeah. It's halflings, hard, isn't it?
Why halflings go on. Yeah. Like, please don't sue us. Would go on adventures. If they feel like there's potentially this divine being just kind of watching out for them, adventuring seems just a little bit less scary.
Yes. Like, aren't you worried? It'll be fine. Mm-hmm. Because it typically is for halflings. It'll be fine.
Yeah. So once a halfling heeds the call to adventure, let's talk a little bit about some of their character traits that you can expect to have the benefit of by playing a halfling. This is going to be on page 28 of the player's handbook for anybody that's interested in looking it up.
Yeah. So halflings, physically, they will range from about 3 feet tall, 40 to 45 pounds, typically paler to dustier red skin. But by the way, as always, do what you want. Like, if you want to have give them purple skin, you do you. Big deal. And kind of brown or tawny hair that kind of sometimes is like wavy or curly, with brown and or hazel eyes, that kind of range. So they're like, again, they're very simple. There's nothing exciting about just the way they look, right? Whereas like elves can be like almost silvery complexion like the moon, or golden hues like the, the sun, or you know, black like the Underdark. These guys, they're nothing special. And that's the charm of them. And that keeps them out of the notice of people who would do them harm, right? Or want to exploit them. They live about 150 years, so about double what humans would. And they mature about the same rate, a little slower, get maturity at about 20 years old, much like humans would. So for them, they're a their main ability score increase is going to be a dexterity, which gives them a +2. Again, this is them, you know, not trying to confront problems head on. They're always going to be nimble enough to like jump out of the way or be the perfect candidate for a burglar for a group of wayward dwarves. For alignment, the handbook says that lawful good is the leaning. I think probably I would emphasize more the good side, because even there, when a halfling's being bad, like we said before, it's more like shenanigans than it is about like trying to poison someone or smash their head in with a hammer. Although, you know, as it always goes, you do you. And then lawful, I like that idea when we look at their lore, is it's not so much about everyone keeps the rules. It's about like, hey, an orderly society is a calm, peaceful society.
Yeah, and that's everyone what we keeps want. The peace instead of everyone keeps the rules.
Right, exactly. And so it's not a tyrannical or a very rigid lawful. It's more about like, hey, the common good. It's more like a beefed up social contract, right? For them. And again, when we talk about alignments with all of these races, this is, they're talking in generalities, they're talking in just in broad strokes, this is kind of what they are like as a society. And then so any one example would likely be like this, but individuals are not groups. So make your own choices. I've played halfling barbarians before. They're a lot of fun. And so, yeah, so that's the alignment. And remember too, alignment is descriptive, not prescriptive. Doesn't mean that you have to do this. It means your alignment reflects the choices that you make. Mm-hmm. So just, you know, keep that in there. They're considered small, which means that they actually take up less space. Unlike the dwarves who are medium but short, the halflings are actually the category size small, yeah. And their walking speed is 25 feet.
Yeah, let's actually parse that apart just a little bit, because sometimes that size difference, it's not super common, especially within playable characters within D&D, to see True. Anything other than medium. And it does come into play for certain mechanics, especially combat, when you're talking about your 5-foot squares or who can stand where, pass by. So maybe let's elaborate a little bit on the fact that if you're a small sized creature, when you're playing a halfling, what kind of different benefits might that grant you in adventuring scenarios?
Right. So what that means is that in a 5-foot square, it can usually hold in combat, typically one medium sized creature. A 5-foot square can hold, I think, two or maybe four small creatures, so that you can pack them in tighter, of course, and still attack and swing your sword or club or whatever it is that you have. And it also means that some spells may not affect you, because it'll say choose a medium or larger creature. My favorite is the reduce enlarge spell, which basically changes your size category by one, either up or down. And so you would go from not medium to small, but small to tiny. So you go from Labrador to Chihuahua. to put in easy terms. Or if you enlarge them, they get up to human size. And you're like, okay, that's not as impressive. It's just a really big halfling now. they can reach the top shelf in the kitchen. Yay. But that's where that shorter speed comes from. And what it also means too is they have a feature called halfling nimbleness, which means that they can move through the space of any creature that is a size larger than them, which is going to be most PCs and most monsters. And so in combat or in tricky situations where like the door is clogged or the way is blocked because of a crowd, they can just literally just go through their legs and get through without having any kind of penalty or difficulty doing that. So that's kind of nice as well.
Yeah. The next feature on the halfling traits is by far my favorite.
Oh yeah.
And that is, as we've already mentioned numerous times so far, lucky. Halflings yes. have an actual trait, mechanical trait of being lucky within the game, which I just love. And basically the concept there is anytime you roll a one on a d20 for an attack roll, ability check, or a saving throw, you get to re-roll it one yes. time. You get to re-roll it once. If you get another yeah. one, you defy halfling traits and you are very unlucky, but you have to use it. But oh my gosh, what an incredible like feature, yeah. especially if the DM likes to use like critical fails.
Mm-hmm.
like
yeah.
me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the lucky feature is really, really great because all halflings get it and it can save your butt numerous times. As long as you remember that you have it. Mm-hmm. I have seen many people play halflings over the years, and I would say maybe 20 to 50% of the time, they forget that it exists.
It's one of the best traits, too.
Yeah, it really is. Now, my only other complaint with this feature is the name, because the feat lucky is the same as this feature lucky. And it gets very confusing. However, if you want to give a feat to your halfling lucky, the feat to add on top of this, go buck wild. It's amazing combo. You're making long shot from the X-Men. It's great.
Yeah, I forgot that there was actually a lucky feat as well.
Yes.
Because, you know, I think as this game gets older and bigger with additional content that that wizards are just struggling a little bit to maybe maintain the structure. It's like building a house and then just putting add-ons where things start to get a little bit weird as you keep going. Cool. Yeah. And then their other feature is that they are brave.
Yes. So they are brave, which is really nice. And that basically means that you have advantage on saving throws against being frightened as the condition, which is really great because it gives them that kind of like plucky, everything goes my way vibe. It really enforces that, which is really, really awesome. And the frightened condition doesn't get used a whole lot in my experience, although it should, because it gives you gives the player disadvantage on a ton of things and they can't get closer to the object of the fear. It's just really great. And a lot of ironically, or perhaps on purpose, a lot of the older dragons have an aura of fear and can just freak people out. But when your halfling comes up on your, I don't know, let's just say red dragon inside its horde inside the mountain and causes fear and you have advantage on the check and you make it, interesting. So, yeah, you're trying not to bust out laughing. Yeah, I know. So that's a really nice feature. And it just kind of gives them that like, everything's going to be okay. It'll all turn out in the end.
Yeah. And again, like that makes total sense with what we were talking about with their history, where you have this deity just kind of looking out for you. Like, of course, you would be a little bit more bolstered and puff your chest out just a little bit more because you believe that there is something just kind of probably keep you a little bit safe. So yeah. that feature, that trait actually makes more sense to me now as to why it's there and the mechanics of why it's there than it had before.
Yeah. Now, I will say one other thing is that as we were talking about luck before, in Xanathar's, there's new feats in there as well. And one of them is halfling specific called Bountiful Luck, which basically means they can let other people borrow that innate luck. And so basically when an ally within 30 feet rolls a one on the D20 for the same things, you can use your reaction and let them reroll it like they're a halfling. But that means you don't get to use it until your next turn because you gave up your option to be lucky.
Okay.
Which is kind of fun too. Shared,
yeah.
Yes. You can share that halfling luck, which is just, this is kind of cool. I like that a lot.
Getting excited just talking about it. Mm-hmm. And then the last main trait, which isn't necessarily anything like a skill numbered wise, is basically what do they speak? What kind of language do they communicate in when you're building a halfling?
Yeah, so they can read, write, and speak common and halfling. And what I love this is it says that halfling language isn't a secret, but they're loath to share it with others. They don't have a lot of like written down things. And so it's not really easy to find. And so in my mind, it's just like, because they are oftentimes off in some, you know, forgotten corner of the world living like, you know, a peaceful life, or they have their own kind of sections of the city where they just as are living in a human city or part of a larger culture, that because it's not written down anywhere, and they like I kind of like they only speak it at home, but out in the marketplace and adventuring they'll speak, you know, common to everybody. It's just not easy to get it in to learn it, because it's not like, you know, it's not one of the options in Rosetta Stone, like you just can't go learn it. So it seems like if you're close with halfling and halfling culture, they might teach it to you. But it's the closest thing to like a natural secret like language that you might be able to use, like to send codes. And it's like the Navajo during World War II with the code talkers, like no one knew Navajo. And so it was really hard to break that code for that and other reasons. So I always kind of think of it as like Cockney rhyme scheme. You hear people using it and you're like, I recognize some of those words. I have no idea what they're saying. That's amazing. And there's not like, you can't just go find big libraries full of Cockney rhyme scheme books, but it's out there. So that's kind of how I think of halfling.
So this is a little tiny bit off topic of halfling specifically, but you mentioned, you know, when a halfling gets in your party, they might be willing to teach you, you know, halfling as a language. What's the mechanic for learning a new language? If a player wants to like integrate that into their campaign, how long would that take, or how would you run that?
Yeah, so there's actually rules for it, going back to season one mode for a second, that there is downtime activities.
That would be considered a downtime one. Okay, it's not like while you're just walking down the cavern, you can just be like teaching them a couple random words, or like, yeah, that's the word for rock.
Yeah, you could do that for sure, absolutely. So between adventuring on page 187, The bottom of page 187, you can spend time during adventures learning a new language or training with a set of tools. You must find an instructor willing to teach you. They describe how long it takes and whether you have to do a couple of ability checks to do that. The training lasts for 250 days and costs 1 GP per day. After you spend the requisite amount of time and money, you learn the new language or proficiency with that new tool. So those are just the guidelines to do that. And 250 days may seem like a long time, but like when they're not learning like how to like, you know, order a sandwich to ask where the bathroom is in Halfling, you're learning the language. Like you could, you know, give a eulogy in Halfling. You could have a long conversation as you're studying abroad at Halfling Society or whatever. So that's kind of the guidepost for you on 187 in the Player's Handbook.
It could be fun too as a DM if like you really wanted to get into that to like roll on the number of words that you learned that day through adventuring that you actually retain,
so
or like have like a table that you roll on. You're like, you learned these 6 words today. But like eventually, if that player wants to try to like parse together a sentence out of these random words, I don't know. That's the way my brain works.
No, that'd be so good too. And Jen just like, oh, I speak a little Halfling. Let me try. And you're like, all right, make an intelligence check. And they're like, oh no. Well, you said you wish you could marry his pizza. I didn't even know pizza was a Halfling word. So good job.
Okay. So, and I mean, that makes sense too, that they don't, I was thinking at first like, oh, curiosity, why wouldn't they have another language on there? But they're secluded. They don't necessarily, as much as they're friends with people, they're not necessarily out being like having exposure to all of these different languages. So I think that if you're playing a Halfling, it would make a lot of sense that you would strive to learn an additional language, maybe one of like a party member or something like that.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't, before you go adventuring, you wouldn't have access really to that mentor or that person to learn this extra language necessarily, depending on backstory and some other stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing too, is a lot of classes will give you an extra language sometimes. And there's feats that you can take and things like that to where it might make sense with the character's backstory that, yeah, they learned, you know, how to speak, like Sylvan or something, because they're wandering and they meet up with the same group of like satyrs every year to trade. And they've learned, you know, Sylvan to be able to talk to them or whatever, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, so those are the traits, the organic traits that all Halflings have, but depending on your subrace, you get some additional or different benefits to what we just talked about. So let's talk about the different Halfling subraces that you get to pick from when you are building a Halfling character.
So the most common is going to be the Lightfoot Halfling. Even the book kind of calls it out, like they're the ones that are kind of more nimble and they're a little more slight of build. And in the Forgotten Realms, at least, they're the ones you can find almost anywhere. They're kind of really integrated into like everything. And so for them, for the Lightfoot Halflings, in addition to what you already get for just being a Halfling, just the table stakes, you also get a +1 to your charisma, which makes a lot of sense. We talked about relationships before. And then they're also naturally stealthy. So you can attempt to hide even when you're obscured only by a creature that is at least one size larger than you, which of course is almost everyone. So these are great for like kind of roguish things, like our Tolkien burglar example, or even like bards and things like that. These people really have integrated into larger multi-race societies. And so they're affable and they've learned how to just kind of get out of the way of other things happening around to keep themselves safe.
Yeah, I had a Halfling, I think it was when I was playing through Lost Mines, that as their bonus action every turn because of their class, I think it was Rogue, I don't entirely remember, they were able to take hide as the bonus action.
Yeah.
So after the end of every turn, they would just go run and hide behind one of their party members.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they always stayed within like their distance, and they'd be like, as a bonus action, I'd like to hide. And that just became our catchphrase at the table, because every single turn in combat, as a bonus action, I'd like to hide. It was very effective for them, especially because I think with the rogue, then you can get your sneak attack if you're not seen and some other stuff. And so like that stuff can really build if you pay attention to it.
Yeah, that reminds me immediately of that scene from Pitch Perfect 3 where Anna Kendrick just shows up, like sneaks into a group of hostages. And they're like, when'd you get here? I've always been here. I'm just really small. And I was just like, Yeah, that's perfect Lightfoot halfling energy right there.
Is there anything else notable about the Lightfoot other than being a little bit more stealthy and their ability score increase and like just the fact that they're probably a little bit more common to see?
Yeah, not really. I think they're just kind of what we typically think of when we think of halflings. I mean, if we wanted to, this would be very much, you know, Frodo is a Lightfoot, whereas the next one, the Stout, is more like Samwise. And kind of like what they're good at and things. So yeah, that's kind of it for the Lightfoots.
Okay. So let's dive into Samwise, as you put it.
The Samwise, gosh. All right, anyway. Okay, so the Stout Halflings, they're a little bit more hardy. They're more like, as the name is just stout, a little stocky. And the lore here says that some of them even say that they have dwarven blood in them. And so what for them, in addition to the table stakes of just being a halfling, they also get a +1 to their constitution, which is really nice. Anytime you can get a +2 to your constitution, you should go for it. And they have advantages on saving throws against poison, and they have resistance against poison damage.
Unsurprisingly, with con. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And when they have a +1 with the con, so it's even easier. And so, again, it's that kind of like nod that there might be a little like a dwarven commingling going on there for those guys, because it's just like it says for the dwarven entry as well. So, yeah, so those are the stout ones. Those, in my mind, like as we've read the lore, these are the ones who are like off in their own communities that eventually will venture out. They're not hiding. They're just content to live in peace and harmony, whereas the Lightfoots are the ones who are going to be kind of intermixed with larger, like, you know, elf and human and dwarf and gnome society. Like you go into a city like Waterdeep where it's just everything. I think that the Lightfoots would be there. And then if you go to like a city that's or a township that's just all halflings, that might be more stouts.
That makes a little bit more sense too, because like when you were talking about stouts, it just made me think of like the people that are having to grow and make all their own food and churn their own butter and like do the basically like the farm work, if you will, the heavy lifting. Whereas the halflings that are maybe living in different types of communities, well, I'll just pay you to do that for me.
Yeah.
So they're not going to like build those muscles the same way because they have like a different access to resources. So in that regard, it makes a lot of sense to me too.
Right. And so now these are the only two subraces that are in the player's handbook. And there's some other like subraces in the Eberron book. And if you look in D&D Beyond, you might see like the different like dragon shard marks for those. But those are more or less basically the same as what we've already covered. However, there are two other subraces that you can find in the Sword Coast Adventurers Guide, which is really great. And a lot of people overlook it because there's some really great options in there. And it was published really early on in fifth edition's history. And so a lot of people came into the game after it was published. And so it gets overlooked. And one of them is the Ghostwise Halfling, which is pretty phenomenal, because the idea with these is they've taken that, hey, we're going to live off by ourselves and kind of keep ourselves safe by obscurity up to 11. And so they are much more, we don't mix with other people. We don't really like outsiders coming in. We just want to do our own thing and live in peace. You guys can go off and fight your wars and deal with your dragons and fight with dwarves. Like, we don't care. We're just going to be over here. And so they're very clannish and mistrustful of outsiders. And so they're very kind of secretive. And in the lore, it has them living in like one specific place, kind of off in a corner there in the Forgotten Realms.
It reminds me of, again, Tolkien, or at least like, you know, the Lord of the Rings movie, when Gandalf is coming to the Shire and the hobbit couple that are outside and they're just glaring at him because they know he's up to no good.
Like, yeah.
That's
tall
kinda,
wizards.
Yeah. They're an outsider. They don't belong here. What's going to happen? Yeah. I don't think you should be here. That kind of mentality.
Yeah. Those Baggins always consorting with weird people and unsightly for behavior for a halfling. Exactly. So with the Ghostwise Halflings, they get a additional bonus of one to their wisdom score, which is kind of fun. So that makes great for perception checks and also things like clerics that need to use wisdom for their stuff. That's fun. And then they have something called called silent speech. So they can speak telepathically to any creature within 30 feet of them.
And that's just, so I know that there's some creatures that can do that, but it's through like spores or other types of mechanic. This is just like, is it magical? Where does that fall on the spectrum? Well,
so here's the thing. I don't think it's magical. I think it's psionic. It's like Professor Xavier or Jean Grey. It's just like they have telepathy. It's not a magical effect. Mm. It is a mental effect. And so they can speak telepathically to any creature within 30 feet, and they can only understand you if you share a common language. And they can only do it one at a time. So it's not a big hive mind. It's like they can, it's all the same rules as verbal speech, but it can be done telepathically.
Wouldn't that be a great ability to have when you're trying to tell your spouse that you want to leave your mother-in-law's house?
Yes, that would be a great... Now we just like kind of like on the sly text them and like hoping they're looking at their phone. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, so those are super cool because generally speaking, if you want to be able to have like telepathy in D&D, you have to like become a warlock with the patron of the of like the ancient gods or whatever they call it. I forget what it is now, where you get telepathy. But this is just a race that just starts with telepathy. And I think that's super awesome.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense too. Like if they live in their own, like all of that makes sense. Now you mentioned a second subrace that's in that same lore that piqued my interest when you had mentioned it before we started recording, which was the Lotus Den. Yes. And I like am all about the lotus flower in general. And so do tell, because as soon as you said that, I was like, I want to know more about what the Lotus Den are.
Yeah. So just a quick point of order here. In their description, it says that long tied to the natural heart of the Lotus Den Greenwood, these halflings have adapted to live synergistically with the chaotic laws of the wilds. So they're leaning more towards like some of more of the fey creatures, though they are not fey themselves. I also think it's really funny that there is a place called the Greenwood, probably named for Ed Greenwood, who basically created most of the Forgotten Realms. And this is in the Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide. So there's probably some fun little things there too. So they also get an ability score increase of 1 to their wisdom. So the same as the Ghostwise. And then they have 2 more. And here they actually do have some innate magical abilities. The Child of the Wood, which means they learn the Druidcraft cantrip. And at 3rd level, they can cast the Entangle spell once per long rest. At 5th level, they gain Spike Growth once per long rest. And they use Wisdom, of course, for the spell casting ability for these. So they're like little like mini druids naturally. And so this matches very well with things that you'll see with like tieflings when we do those guys, that they have some... and like the drow, they have some innate magic that levels with them, not because of their class, but because of the race. And it's very woodsy, druid-ish kind of tinge to it all.
Yeah, that would probably be a great combo with a ranger.
Yeah, that would be really cool, actually. I like that a lot.
Right.
Or you can mix and match it with different things, like make him a barbarian, you know, they can just cast Entangle and I don't know. Anyway. And then they have Timberwalk. So ability checks made to track you have disadvantage. And you can move across difficult terrain made of non-magical plants and undergrowth without expending extra movement. So these are straight up wood assassins. They can just sneak through the trees unseen because of their small stature. They can go through the underbrush and they won't get caught. They can lure people into traps. They can cause traps with the spike growth and the entanglement spell. And they still have their +2 to dexterity because they're halflings still, and destroy you with arrows or ask you why you are in their wood before they call on their much scarier allies who live in that forest as well. So, yeah, I like the Lotus Den ones a lot.
Yeah, I am not disappointed. And now I'm like, where is there a game I can join that I can play this now? The first thought going through my head.
Yeah. I'm super hyped on like the Ghostwise ones as well, because I'm all like, I didn't realize that they could do telepathy. That's kind of neat. Yeah, I kind of have an assassin character in mind now of Ghostwise hobbit. Sorry, halfling. So yeah.
So what are some of your favorite, I mean, we've mentioned a couple, but let's close this out by talking about what some of your favorite combinations are. If you're going to play a halfling, what do you think are some really interesting ways to leverage their innate traits or kind of like qualities?
Yeah, so I think that typically speaking, because you have that bump to dexterity, and you've got the nimbleness that you can kind of hide behind things really easily, as you said, that rogue is a natural choice. And also because of the Tolkien combination, it's also a natural choice as well to have that burglar in your party. But there's other options as well, especially if you're going to be picking something like a ranger or even a druid. That would be really nice too, because you have things like bonus to constitution or bonuses to wisdom with the other subraces we picked. And so anything that's going to be using range as an attack, it might be really nice to pick. Oh yeah,
because of that dex too, because that's the number you use for ranged attacks. That makes a lot of sense.
Exactly. So a fighter with an archery specialty fighting style, rangers would be really good for this as well, especially if you do the Lotus Den, or even if you decide that you're going to be like a bard because of the Lightfoot halfling, where you get the bonus to charisma. That's great too, because there's a ton of finesse weapons you can choose from as well. And because of that relationship, and bards are natural storytellers and they travel from town to town telling tales and gathering stories and seeing new and novel things, there's a really easy narrative and statistical reason to make a bard as well. I mean, I'll always recommend bard, but I think this time it's warranted for the halflings. So anything along that kind of roguish spectrum, or anything that has ranged attacks, I think halfling's a good choice.
Thank you guys so much for equipping the compendium today. If you're interested in diving into a different type of character development, consider checking out my brand new life coaching experience, the Identity D&D Workshop. I handcrafted this experience using the framework of building a D&D character with some of the tools that I know as a life coach to help people do an investigation check on themselves and who they really want to show up as in life. As a special thank you, Compendium listeners can get $25 off this 5-hour workshop by using the code COMPENDIUM, that's COMPENDM, at registration. Just visit www.envisagelifecoach.com and click on workshops to learn more or register. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already done so, since episodes are published every Tuesday and Friday, or Monday and Thursdays if you're a patron on our Patreon account. If you enjoy listening each week, a great way to help support the show outside of contributing to our Patreon is just by sharing a link to this episode with one of your friends that you think might like it too. We hope to see you back in a few days for the next episode, where we're going to be continuing our discussion, delving further into the world of D&D.